Thank you everyone for coming on such short notice. We're very fortunate to have someone who needs no introduction here. I was very fortunate to meet the Rav about a month and a half ago, I guess, in Toronto. Luckily, just worked out that he was coming to New York for a week, and we were lucky enough, Great Neck was lucky enough to have him for just this short while. So thank you all for coming out. This is the renowned posek in Eretz Yisrael, in Israel. The Rav is a posek for Shari Tzedek Hospital. He is involved with all segments of Israeli society, has a lot of tremendous experience from America originally. He's a Rosh HaKolel, he's the author of the Minchas Asher, Hagon, Rav Asher Weiss.
So it's, I think this is my first visit to the Great Neck community. I visited many, many communities in North America, Europe, South Africa, Israel, South America, but first time in Great Neck in this beautiful shul, and I'm happy to be with you tonight. I saw the flyer that I am expected to discuss some of the halachic issues and dilemmas facing the security establishment in Israel, and of the many duties I fulfill and many responsibilities I carry, I am also deeply involved with the IDF, with the Mossad, with the Israeli police, as well with the medical establishment in Israel, and we have unique challenges. And it is a privilege and also an awesome responsibility to carry this burden. And it is the challenge of our time, because Israel is a country in transformation, and it is a very dynamic society, and more and more from boys are in the security establishment. I was shocked to learn that 25% of the field agents in the Mossad are Dati. And we deal with many, many halachic dilemmas and questions, and we will discuss some of them. So as one could imagine, the greatest challenge in any endeavor, any huge in public endeavor, whether it's the Shari Tzedek Hospital or other hospitals and medical facilities, whether in Israel or in America, as well as in the security forces, Shabbos is the greatest challenge. How do we strictly observe Shabbos while needing to do whatever needs to be done? And I wrote in my sefer, in the Minchas Asher, that regarding Shabbos in a modern state, it is a challenge which we did not need to face for more than 2,000 years. Because the last time the Jewish people needed to run a sovereign state was in the days of David HaMelech, not even in the days of Bayis Sheni, because in Bayis Sheni we had the Beis HaMikdash, but we weren't really in control. We had some autonomy under the Roman Empire. So Baruch Hashem, our generation had the schus after more than 2,000 years to come back to our beloved and holy land and to restore sovereignty, Jewish sovereignty in the land. And this is a unique challenge. And sometimes when we have halachic dilemmas, we need to go all the way back to the Tanakh, because these are questions which weren't discussed in 1,000 years of responsa, of shelot v'tshuvot that we find in the poskim. From the days of the Gaonim, Rabbeinu Sadia Gaon v'Rav Hai Gaon, and then the Rishonim like the Rambam and the Ramban, up to our present day, we never needed to run a Jewish state. So in Tavshin Ches, 1948, when the state was established, and we do find discussions between the great poskim, how do we keep Shabbos? And so Rav Herzog has a tshuva today, quite amusing, and he suggests that the police, Shabbos, don't drive cars, but ride on mules, donkeys. Today, I think that would be a far-fetched proposition. Instead of using vehicles, it definitely would be an attraction, having the police ride on donkeys, on mules. So this is a challenge of our generation. Our fathers, forefathers didn't need to deal with. And this brings up so many questions. So in our day and age, we deal with the concept of pikuach nefesh with a much broader scope. So in all the shelot v'tshuvot that we find, and all the poskim, we're dealing with an individual, with a family. The macro was the community, the town, never huge systems like running a state. How do we define, what are the limits, what are the boundaries of pikuach nefesh? And I'll give an example from Shaarei Tzedek Hospital and an example from the IDF. What are the boundaries of pikuach nefesh? So everybody knows how important it is to follow protocol in a hospital. So every drug that is administered must be recorded and registered. It is important, even though in the vast majority of cases, it would not affect pikuach nefesh directly. So you gave a patient aspirin because he had a headache. Why would that be defined as pikuach nefesh? But if we let every nurse decide what is important to register and what not, in the long run, people will pay with their lives. So just keeping protocol definitely is important. Would that be defined as pikuach nefesh? So would we let a firm nurse who is strictly observant write or use a computer to just keep records of every drug and everything that happened? So if the patient wasn't feeling well in the middle of the week, we definitely would have that written down. Would we do the same on Shabbos? Could we rely on every nurse to decide on her own what is more important and what is less important? What might be, in a certain situation, life-saving or life-threatening, and what might not be? So let me give you an example that actually happened in the IDF. So there's a unit in the intelligence, and they're just sitting with computers, and almost every hook and cranny in every street and every alley in what many define as the occupied territories, and I don't like that definition, in Judea and Samaria, is we have surveillance cameras everywhere, and primarily those people are girls that have more patience than the boys, just to sit and observe and record everything that might be of significance. So there was a truck that had an accident and hit a telephone pole, which fell down. And the girl, observing that, thought, well, this has no military significance. Why is this important? Why would I be Machal Shabbos to just have this recorded? And so she just ignored it. And a week later, there was an Israeli patrol that was ambushed there, and two soldiers were killed. And she wasn't aware that the Palestinians thought that there is a camera on that pole, and they intentionally staged that accident to topple the pole, and the military wasn't informed that that happened. And nobody knew that that camera is no longer working. And that is why they were successful in ambushing an Israeli patrol and hurting those soldiers, which is just an example of, we cannot let everyone, every individual, decide on his own what might be pikuach nefesh and what might not be pikuach nefesh. So observing protocol is extremely important. Even though it would be very far-fetched to assume that this might be a pikuach nefesh situation, but it just might be. So another example, in the IDF. So I don't know whether anybody sitting here has any experience in military service, but every tank has a turret. And the cannon is fixed in the turret. So you cannot use the cannon unless you turn the turret. And there are two ways to turn the turret. There's the manual one, which we usually use when in maintenance. But in combat, there is the hydraulic system. Today it's electronic, but once it was hydraulic. And there is a strict order. Before one of the four soldiers sitting in a tank, every tank has four soldiers, the commander, the driver, Ta'an Kashar, and the Totchan, the one that operates the cannon, and the one that is Ta'an Kashar.
The loader?
Yeah, he loads the shells, the Pagazim, and he is also the radio man. So it is a strict order. Nobody moves in the tank unless the hydraulic system is shut off, because it's very cramped in a tank and it's full of heavy steel. And if you stand up and somebody turns the turret, you will be instantly killed. And therefore, nobody moves in a tank unless the system is shut off. So four from boys talking to each other are sitting in the tank. One wants to leave the tank, and it's Shabbos. And shutting off the electronic system would be defined as a malacha. Maybe a malacha d'oraisa, in my opinion. At least a malacha d'rabbana, like closing or connecting any electrical circuit. And these boys talk to each other. And they say, I'm leaving the tank, nobody turned the turret. Do they need to operate according to these orders and shut off the system before they get out? So right here and now, this would not be a pikuach nefesh situation. But if we rule that you could ignore protocol, then sooner or later, somebody, a tragedy will happen, an accident will happen, and sooner or later, someone will pay with his life. So when pikuach nefesh is indirect, it is not immediate, it's not right here and now, but somewhere along the line, would that be defined as pikuach nefesh? So I wrote an interesting tshuva on this topic, and my conclusion is yes, even an indirect pikuach nefesh would be defined as pikuach nefesh. And I proved that from various different sources. I'll share one with you. And that is the Beit Yosef, Yoredeya Simen Kufayin Tes, dealing with a totally different topic. So Yoredeya Kufayin Tes, we deal with Chukot Ha'akum, Chukot Ha'nochrim. B'chukotayim lo telechu. We need to stand apart. We need to be different. And we cannot follow their customs. And there's a Gemara in Bava Kama that Beis Rebbe, the family of the Nasi, Nasi Yisrael, in the days of the Beis HaMikdash, one of the fundamental institutions of the Jewish people was the Nisiyut, the presidency. Rabban Gamliel was the president. His grandfather, Hillel HaZaken, following Shmaya v'Avtalion. So, Chachomim were lenient, and it is permissible for the family of the Nasi, Lisaper Kumi, and that is a certain haircut, hairstyle, which only the Gentiles used, and it originated by the priests. So that would be a prohibition of B'chukoteim lo torechu. But Chachamim were lenient regarding the Nasi, the president, and his family. Why is that? Because they were mekuravim lemalchut. So why is that important? The Beis Yosef explains. Because sometimes, we need the right people with the right connections in the right places. And if there's an anti-Jewish decree, we want those people to intervene and have influence, and you can't have influence if you're so different. So that is why they were similar in dress and custom to the non-Jewish authorities. So they had a special permit to Lesapa Kumi, to use those haircuts. According to the Vesyosef, we're dealing with an Isidi Uraisa, with a biblical transgression, a biblical precept. And nevertheless, that was defined, according to the Vesyosef, as Pikuach Nefesh. So the Pikuach Nefesh is not immediate. It's not right here and now. But down the line, that might affect Pikuach Nefesh. And therefore, Chachamim were lenient regarding the prohibition of B'chukoteyam Lo Telechu. And I brought various different sources proving this point. So some years ago, I had a question, not from the Israeli establishment and not from Shari Tzedek, but rather from South Africa, from Johannesburg. So there's a beautiful Jewish community in Johannesburg, the biggest Jewish community, I think, in Africa as a whole, in the entirety of Africa. And they have a very active Hatzalah group. And in Johannesburg, it is more important and essential than probably any other Jewish community in the world, because the basic medical services are very, very poor. And the Jewish community has its volunteers, and they save lives almost on a daily basis. And recently, the government came up with new regulations, and you cannot have a license to be a paramedic unless in your training you need to serve 2 weeks in a public medical facility. The stress is not a private facility, but a public medical facility. And South Africa has the highest AIDS affected population in the world. So Jewish people, white people, would never go to a public facility in Johannesburg. So if a Jewish boy, an observant boy, needs to serve 2 weeks consecutively every day, that includes Shabbosim, could he work in a public hospital? The chances that there will be a Jewish patient there are non-existent at all, and he will need to be Mechal Shabbos throughout the Shabbos. So, if he won't, then right now we still have enough volunteers, but 5 years down the line, there will be no Hatzalah in Johannesburg. And if there will be no Hatzalah, that means many Jewish lives would be in jeopardy. Would that be defined as a Pikuach Nefesh situation to permit being a Mechal Shabbos right here and now? Because in another 5 years, we won't have licensed paramedics, we won't have a Hatzalah. So my response was, maybe in pure halachic criteria, maybe it would be permissible. But I feel extremely uncomfortable permitting Chil Shabbos on a daily basis, right here and now, because 5 years from now, we need a Hatzalah. Many things could happen in 5 years. And my response was to the Rabbonim, I think you need to contact our friends in the Christian community, in the Muslim community. They should try to intervene for us, people of faith, people of religion. And they should intervene and try to influence the government officials to be forthcoming, to let us skip Shabbos, and we will serve, okay, 14 days, but let's exclude Shabbosim and B'siyata D'Shmaya. It was successful. So this is a good example of a halachic dilemma on one hand, and the halachic approach, but on the other hand, how careful and cautious and diligent we need to be trying to prevent Chilul Shabbos and trying to solve problems and without relying on basic halachic criteria and how to try to uphold our ancient values and Kedushas HaShabbos while navigating in a modern world and seeing to it that we serve our communities in the best way. So, after what happened in Pittsburgh some months ago, I was asked by many Jewish shuls and Jewish communities about having security in their shuls on Shabbos. And the police argues that we're not familiar with the congregants. It is only your members that we know to identify suspicious faces, suspicious people. So we need your cooperation. And okay, so we will bring the heavy arms, but we need your congregants and members of your community to take care of the basic structure of security. So I was asked by many communities, could we have volunteers, and they will need to be armed, and they will need to have use cell phones or other means of communications, and they will need to have, well, once 100 years ago we spoke about walkie-talkies. I assume today they have different names. So would that be permissible? And once again, by basic halachic criteria, we're dealing with isurim kalim biyoter. It's all about mukta. Because if we need to use firearms, okay, that is already a real pikuach nefesh situation, and we hope there never will be a need. But, so what are we dealing with? The prohibition of tiltul mukta, and that is not a very serious transgression. Especially the concept, either firearms or means of communication, is a davar shemelachto liisur. Davar shemelachto liisur mutar teltel tzorach gufo. And this is tzorach gufo. And therefore, I don't think there would be any halachic problem at all. I think guns, firearms, would be defined not only as a davar shemelachto liisur, probably mukze machmat chasron kis, because you don't use a gun to scratch your head. You use a gun to shoot or to deter and give a feeling of security to the community when they know that armed people, if need be, can use firearms, and that gives a sense of security to the community. So that would be defined as tzorach gufo. So I don't think we're dealing with a major halachic issue. However, what I suggested and strongly recommend is having the respected members of the community participating in this endeavor. The Talmidei Chachamim and those that are known to be serious in their commitment to Yiddishkeit, that these devices should not be abused, and they should not be used just to chat with each other or just to say hello, but they should only be used if need arises. So I would be forthcoming in my halachic response on the condition that the respected members of the community, not only the youngsters, but the Talmidei Chachamim and the elders, they be amongst those that volunteer, that all the members of the security team should understand that we do not use the devices only if a real threat or real security need comes up. So these are some of the halachic issues which we need to deal with in our modern world. And I gave you a few examples from the hospital. Just one moment, some examples from the medical establishment, security establishment, and others. Yes?
You can carry?
Carry? Oh, in Rishus HaRabim.
Huh?
Carry in Rishus HaRabim. You mean from your home to the shul?
Oh, but the shul.
Of course, because we're only dealing with tiltul mukze. So if it's only mukze, I said it's tzorach gufo, and that would not be a problem. I thought you were asking, so could you bring things from your home to the shul? And that is carrying mereshut lereshut bereshut arabim. So obviously, those walkie-talkies or communications devices you could lock up somewhere in shul. firearms, you need to be responsible and take them home with you. You can't leave guns in shul, because that would be probably a greater danger, a greater threat than terror attacks. You know, people might break into the room. So if you have firearms, you need to take them home with you and keep them in your safe at home. So that would be a serious question, carrying from your home to shul. And that's derech reshut harabim. So the solution is, according to the Ramo, and that is the minig of Ashkenazim, there is no reshus harabim bizman hazeh. According to the Beit Yosef, and that is the custom of our Sephardi brethren, there is a reshut harabim bizman hazeh. But if you carry those firearms kil achar yad, lo kidderech nesiyah, we're dealing with a shavus. If we assume there is no reshus harabim bizman hazeh, it's a shavus, the shavus. Shavus, the shavus. Mutar v'mokem tzorech godol. And this would be defined as a tzorech godol. I also suggested that even if we set up security teams in our shuls, it should be for 3 month periods. And with cooperation with the police, you know, because when danger subsides, I don't think there will be a need. Understanding the nature of terror and the warped mind of terrorists, whenever there's a terror attack, there might be others. It brings the awareness, and especially if it was a successful attack, it encourages others to do the same. And that is why after every terror attack, there is more carefulness and more caution, and the police are far more afraid that there might be others. So even if we do set up a security apparatus in our shuls and our communities, it shouldn't be, you know, a decision that should go on forever, but discussing with the police, with the FBI, with the security agencies to determine the level of danger, of threat. And if things calm down, I don't think there would be a need to have, you know, these teams working in our shuls on a steady basis. Some dilemmas that are more associated with the Mossad and the real, more secretive arms of intelligence in Israel, and especially field agents. And some of them are really observant and really serious about their mitzvahs and their observance. And when you are in alien countries, you can have nothing with you that even remotely would disclose your true identity. You can't have a siddur, you can't have tefillin, not even on your computer could you have anything that would be religious. So one cannot put on tefillin, cannot have a siddur, not even on his computer. So would it be at all permissible for an observant boy or girl to volunteer to this type of service? Bearing in mind, knowing in advance that there will be times, usually very short times, that you will not be able to observe Yiddishkeit. And that is a very grave question. But on the other hand, there are very few people that have what it takes to do this service. Very few. And out of 100 interviews that the Mossad do, maybe one is found fitting to serve. And there aren't many people that have what is needed to be a spy or a field agent. And therefore, I think we cannot say that a frum boy is prohibited from volunteering to the service. I think each and every one makes such a difference and would be defined as pikuach nefesh. So let me share a story with you. Amusing, interesting. I have a very close friend. I doubt he will want me to mention his name because it's a personal, a very close friend. very from family, but also very idealistic and very Zionistic and very dedicated to serve the state of Israel. And one of his daughters volunteered to the Mossad, and he came together with his daughter to ask a brocha from me. And from the depth of my heart, I gave her a brocha that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should watch over her, and she always should come home safely. And so on her very first assignment, she had to pretend to be Christian, and she had to wear a cross. And she said, whenever she closed her eyes, she saw the face of Rabbi Shavais, and she couldn't bear it. I haunted her, she said, like Yosef at Tzaddik, when he had the greatest Nisayan, and suddenly he sees the most Yukonoi of his great father, of Yaakov Avinu, and that is what saved him from sin. So this girl, after her very first assignment, she said, I can't do this. Rabbi Shavais is after me. Whenever I close my eyes, I saw his face and I heard his bracha. So she gave back the keys and she said, I want an office assignment. So that was the end, or maybe the beginning of her service. And I was inspired by this young girl who was so idealistic and so willing to serve. But her father, even though he's a big Zionist, was very happy that that was the end of the story. And because, yes, somebody's got to do the job, and it is pikuach nefesh. But when you know it's your child out there in some enemy country, it's really a reason to be afraid. So these are some of the halachic dilemmas that we deal with on a day-to-day basis and questions that come to my table from the various different security organizations. Yes? I don't think we need to deal with Oisik b'mitzvah, potam and mitzvah. That would be a very questionable discussion. I don't think it could be defined as Oisik b'mitzvah. Oisik b'mitzvah is when you're Oisik in Ksiva Sefer Torah and Kriya Shema. I think it would more be the question of pikuach nefesh overriding other mitzvahs. So one of the common questions, Me'inyan le'inyan ba'oto inyan. So we're not dealing with spies that spend many years in enemy countries. There are some of those, but in most cases, in the vast majority of cases, it is being a few days in an alien territory, days, a week, and then coming back. So this person has no tefillin, he has no sitter, he has nothing. So, and then he finished his assignment. Does he have to take the first plane and rush back to Israel and arrive before the Shkia to put on tefillin? Or he could take his time and go from this country and drive to a neighboring country, which is a friendly country, and spend some time there. So doesn't need to rush home, but he needs to try as soon as possible to get tefillin, get tzitzis, get a sitter, and doesn't necessarily need to be back in Israel, but in a neighboring country. But yes, as soon as you did your duty and you're back in a friendly country, you are just like all the others, and you need to perform each and every mitzvah with diligence. I just remember another question that came to me from the police. So there was an Arab group that specialized in stealing Sifrei Torah. And the police were successful in infiltrating that group and having one of ours being part of that group. But the person, the Jewish person, had a feeling that his friends have an eye on him and they don't trust him. So he asked his operators, could you have a Sefer Torah for me to initiate and to steal and bring to the group just to restore their confidence in me? I have to prove myself. So would it be permissible to set this up and enable him, together with his friends, to steal a Sefer Torah and to take it into their possession? And the police was interested in a heter, because they also wanted to catch that group red-handed. And if you catch them with a Sefer Torah in their possession, then you have a real case to go to court. But if you don't catch them red-handed, you have to prove, and that is far more difficult. So the police came to me, and they were very interested in getting a heter to set something up and have them steal a Sefer Torah and get into their possession. And I did give them a heter, which was based on a very interesting source that we find in Yoredeus in Malaysia, I involved. And that is an interesting principle, that its earliest sources in Shelot V'Tshuvot Maharival, going back 700 years. So there is a prohibition of having benefit from anything that grows in a cemetery, and that is based on the concept of Kvod HaMet. So of trees, plants, fruits grow in a cemetery, you cannot partake from those fruits or use anything that grows in a cemetery. So 700 years ago, in the days of Mahari Vail, there was a Jewish cemetery in a little town, and animals were grazing in the cemetery. And the only way to get those animals off the cemetery was either to build a fence or to bribe the authorities to get those animals out. But there were no funds. And the medieval paskin that you could chop down the trees and sell the wood or use the wood to build a fence around the cemetery. But that would go against the prohibition to use anything, have benefit from anything that grows in a cemetery. So the medieval argues, this halach is based on Kvod HaMeis. But this is a far greater violation of Kvod HaMeis when you have animals grazing in a cemetery and trampling on the Kvorim. So it is preferable to violate Kvod HaMeis to a lesser degree by using those trees and saving the honor of those deceased in a far more horrible way. Even though those animals aren't our animals, we don't bear any direct responsibility. Marival says that doesn't matter. And where does he prove his psak? Going all the way back to the Nach, as I mentioned before. So we have the story of Chizkiyahu HaMelech, who took down Dalsois HaHechel, the doors of the Hechel and Beis HaMikdash, and sent them as a gift to Melech Ashur to appease him. He shouldn't destroy Yerushalayim and destroy the Beis HaMikdash. That is a lav, a transgression of a lo ta'aseh. Lo ta'asun kein l'Hashem Elokeichem. Anybody that destroys any part of the Beis HaMikdash, over al lo ta'asun kein l'Hashem Elokeichem. So Chizkiyahu HaMelech argued, but I prefer destroying part of the Beis HaMikdash and saving the Beis HaMikdash from total destruction. So that is the proof of Marival. And I say, yes, we will have one Sefer Torah for a day in their possession if we could catch them and lock them up and save so many other Sefer Torah from being desecrated by them. So that was the basis of my psak. Yes.
More than swear cross, actually to act in a way that would be avodas kochav, which she then the question of kuch nefesh would be superseded by
That's a very good comment. If we would actually deal with avodah zara, right, needless to say shfichud damim or gilui arayot, there would be no basis for heta. Right.
There's a
So let me tell you this. No decent society would expect that from women. It is not practiced in the Israeli intelligence. The Russians do it. Some other communist countries do it. No, it is not accepted practice. And Israeli intelligence would never expect a woman to violate her purity in her service. That is beyond, that is beyond the boundaries of what is accepted practice. Yes, she or he will have to sit in a restaurant and spend time and eat their food. And you cannot even pretend to be a vegetarian because that might arouse suspicion. You cannot arouse suspicion, and you can't say, I'm a vegetarian, I won't eat meat. That might arouse suspicion. So you will be expected to eat treif and to be machal Shabbos, yes. But a woman would not be expected to engage in any way in Gilui Arayot or in, or definitely not in Shvichut Dami. That is already, if you're already a doctor, but there would be no heter to volunteer to work in a hospital and be a machal Shabbos to treat non-Jewish patients. If you're already a doctor, then that is Evo, that is Pikuach Nefesh, but that would not be a heter b'chat chedet to get into it. Yes, that is what I mentioned before. If you're an Atzola, you treat non-Jews and Jews in exactly the same fashion. But that is when you already are an Atzola member. But we're dealing with a situation in which you're Machal Shabbos now, in order that years down the line, they're yes. I think it's very problematic, and I do think that you need to go out of your way to have a Shem Shabbos residency. And if I know that young students, medical students, can't afford it, but a doctor that could afford it, I say if you need to work on Shabbos, pay someone to come with you and, you know, do the writing instead of you and. There would be a difference because maybe in New York would be like Eretz Yisrael when you're treating so many Jewish patients. And if you're treating Jewish patients, then you cannot discriminate. But if you're somewhere in which there would be no Jewish patients, then that would be very problematic.
You mentioned before
that for Ashkenazi, there are most that in our times. Well, the Ramos says there is no Rishus HaRabim Bezman HaZeh. In our day and age, there are very few places in the world in which 600,000 people convene and converge, and very few places. Today, less than 30 years ago, 40 years ago, because of the trend out to the suburbs, but there are some big cities. I dealt with the Erev in Moscow. In Moscow, the metro system is very developed, and there are some places in Moscow which would be defined as a Rishus HaRabim, but that is very uncommon. There's a few cities in the world which might be a Rishus HaRabim. This is a very well-known controversy regarding the Erev in Manhattan. I wouldn't like to discuss this at length right now, but this is a very well-known dilemma. But this is a Persian community, right? So probably you adhere to the Pesukim of the Beis Yosef anyway, not the Ramo. Yeah, I know you're a vice. So probably you're not Sephardi. Yes.
It's interesting, we're creating a whole new category of Ruach Nefesh, because there's Ruach Nefesh, Safek Ruach Nefesh, and now the Rambam creates this category of potential Ruach Nefesh, which is not really a category that I know of. I understand the reasoning behind it, but is that, I mean, you can almost take that in any situation, say there's always a potential of Ruach Nefesh.
Well, yeah, I understand the difficulty, but the fact that it's the fact that it is a Chiddush, we're living in a changing world, and we need to address Shilas. But my opinion is firmly based on sources. I just quoted one of the sources, but it is firmly substantiated. But I know that it's a novel idea, because in days of yore, previous generations, we didn't need to deal with these questions. You know, today it's a world of macro, not micro. And as I said before, you know, so in every decent society, in every urban center, there are police patrols. Policemen are not only in the station, but they patrol. And it is perceived as of being extremely important, because the presence of police, especially in problematic parts of town, is important as a deterrent, as conveying a sense of security to people. And it was made clear to me there's another objective in this as well, because if things happen, you know, the patrol cars have a pattern. It's not just that they say, go out and drive around wherever you want. And they're dispersed in the city, that if things come up, there should be somebody close by. Would that be defined as pituach nefesh? So would there be any heter for policemen to drive around in cars without really being on a specific assignment, going nowhere, just patrolling the streets? So the police thinks this is very important, but that would be a huge stretch of pikuach nefesh, maybe too much even for me. So if it would be in my power, I would say patrol cars on Shabbos should be driven by non-Jews. But we're not there yet, and the security establishment, neither the army nor the police, say they can't live with such a system in which every patrol car would be driven by a non-Jew. They can't do that. That's you bring up very interesting questions and ideas. I think there would be a preference, even though, in my opinion, as I made clear in the first volume and second volume of Shalos Tshuvos Mechasos, I think closing electrical circuits, I would say we should assume it's D'oraisa, and that is the language I use. We should assume it's D'oraisa. Why do I use this language? Because I can't say in certainty it's a D'oraisa. After all, up to the Chazon Ish, the greatest halachic authorities assume that it's an issa d'rabbanan. I think we should assume that it's an issa d'oraisa. So I definitely would prefer electric cars to the ones that use gas.
So now,
what?
The autonomous
car, I don't think there are totally autonomous cars yet. But they are partially autonomous. So I recently wrote a lengthy tshuva about autonomous cars and ethical and halachic dilemmas regarding autonomous cars. I know that there are some semi-autonomous cars, but you still need to turn on the engine.
It's always on.
What?
It's always on.
It's always on? No, you need to turn on the car.
There's nothing to turn on. It's always on.
I know you can't do the test. I don't understand. Nechnasim v'yotzim, aval kishata nechnas, ata mafil et
ha-marchot. When you get proximate to the car, the car shut itself. When he has a key that with an arc.
This way or that way, you are activating this system. An autonomous car doesn't just decide to take a walk and drive out of your garage because he's bored. one way or another, you're the one that's putting on this car. Yeah. So one of the dilemmas with autonomous cars, אנחנו עוברים מעניין לעניין שלא באותו עניין. So there's an interesting chazanish in Chayshim Mishpat. Person is driving a truck and he loses his brakes. He can't stop the truck. And there's a group of people right before him. But the steering wheel is functioning. He can go left or right. There are people there as well, but less than the ones right across him. What is he supposed to do? Sheva al tasa, and he might kill 20 people. Should he steer left and there's one person standing there? That person's life was not in jeopardy, and you're destroying his life directly by turning the wheel. But if I do nothing, I might be destroying many more lives. It's a fascinating halachic dilemma. And the Chazon Ish paskens, you turn the wheel.
Is it siman?
Siman chafei belikutim chushim mishpat. And his reasoning is fascinating. And he writes, technically, I am killing a person. Because. But in essence, the way we define this act is salvaging lives and saving lives. So one might argue, by clear halachic definition, if you do nothing, you do nothing. It's not me. By turning the steering wheel, it is you. And you're destroying a life that wasn't in danger. But the Chazon Ish argues, in essence, I am not killing, I am saving. And it is one, Yochid keneged rabim, one against the many. So when we plan an autonomous car and you're driving on a road and there's a cliff to your left and there are three people on the road, would we program the car to drive off the cliff? Who would buy such a car? So when we plan and program an autonomous car, do we put ourselves in the driver's seat and we say this driver is entitled, first of all, to protect himself, and we wouldn't throw him off the cliff because he wouldn't drive off the cliff and he wouldn't be expected to drive off the cliff. If people are standing in the way and there's no way he could brake on time to save them, we wouldn't expect him to drive off the cliff and kill himself to save those people that are recklessly standing in the middle of the road. So when we plan this car, are we putting ourselves in the driver's seat or no? We need to say we lose one life to save five others. That's an interesting dilemma. So that is exactly the point the Chazon Ish wants to make. And he says, when you give out a person to be killed, that is, using the language of the Chazon Ish, that is a maisa achzori. It's not defined as an act of salvation. It's defined as an act of cruelty. Those bandits demand, we want to kill one of you, and you give someone out to be killed, that is an act of cruelty. Turning the wheel is an act of mercy. It's a very fine and nuanced swirl distinction, but I identify with it.
So the Chazon Ish sound like one like you're the car. What if you're the programmer who's programming it so that some future...
That is exactly the dilemma I meant to say. So you as a programmer, are you putting yourself in the driver's seat or no? I am impartial. So let me share with you another dilemma. So when we program these cars, and a car loses his brakes or steering power, and he's going to hit someone. So we prefer he hits the Volvo, that is one of the sturdiest and safest cars, than hitting the Ford Focus or another little car, that the passengers sitting in that car would be gravely hurt. But then the guy pays an extra $20,000 to buy a Volvo for cause of a security. You should be aware that you're going to be the most endangered species on the road, because all the autonomous cars will hit you. That's the way they're programmed. So you're going to be the sitting duck in the shooting gallery, because the way we plan and program those cars, they will all hit the Volvo and not the little car. So would that be fair? That wouldn't be fair. So these are ethical and halachic dilemmas that we deal with in this endeavor. One more question.
It's not a question. It's unrelated to the Israeli armed forces and Shimon Shavuot. I'm just fascinated. I came here. My wife, she told me you're here, was speaking here tonight, so I drove it over here. I just wanna I find it very fascinating. I wanna thank you also for being that rabbi person that teaches at Yeshivot Hasdeir, teaches at Mechinot. They have accepted by the Haredim and accepted by Hasidim, and it's always easy to see the division in the Israeli and the Jewish community. It's very difficult, and I'm just fascinated how you were able to be accepted by all the streams. I have some people who likes to hear you speak, and I know in person. So, and this is what I call leadership. But we need more people like this. I hope you can.
It's a miracle. I don't know. I don't know how. I think it's a miracle, like Yitziat Mitzrayim. I believe that life is a mission, and we're here to serve, and we're here to share. And I thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu every day of this unique privilege, because I think I really am not aware of anyone else that has this unique privilege to be accepted in the Litvish world and the Hasidic world and the modern Orthodox world and the Dati Leumi world. I give a shir every other week in the Yeshivat Hasder in Sderot. I was there Purim, and it was such an unbelievable sight, and those boys love me and I love them. And so, what's YouTube? I thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu every day for this gift, and I pray it'll go on. And I have a big kollel, and I try to convey this feeling to my talmidim, and I hope that when time comes and I'll move on, there will be many others to do the same. And before I move on, there should be many others to do the same. So let's hope. I think this is the call of our times, and this is a challenge, and it's a unique privilege, and I thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for it.
Thank you for your time. We have food outside.